Recorded live in Petone, New Zealand, this is the Cinematica Podcast, your weekly guide to what's on at the movies. You can find this and all the other episodes of the show at cinematica.co.nz. Welcome everybody to season 4, episode number 3 of Cinematica. I'm Dan Slevin, and joining me we have in the Cinematica studio
Kaylee, as usual.
Well, not always, as usual. You gallivant around the world a bit on your own merits. But also on the line from that Auckland, we have guest host Sarah Watt from the Sunday Star Times.
Hi there.
Pleasure to have you on board. You're sitting in for Simon today, so your job, I think, is to basically say, well, you know, there's an audience for that whenever we really, you know, bag something. I'm not sure if we're going to be in the mood for bagging stuff this week because it's a pretty good week, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Trying to eat biscuits at the same time as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, what's that about? I look over at Kaylee and then she's got a mouthful of digestive. There's something about 2 weeks ago it was Simon with the peanut butter cake.
Okay, everyone who's listening, to be fair, I took my lunch break a little bit late. We're recording early today. I'm trying to carb load at the moment as I prepare.
All right. In today's episode, we're going to ask the question, is Brandon Cronenberg a chip off the old block? We're going to look at Antiviral to find out. Ballet hopefuls put themselves through hell to win a prestigious competition in first position. And Sarah is going to give us the lowdown on Jurassic Park in 3D. And also she's going to tell us what it's like to go on a glamorous junket to interview movie stars. So we'll be finding out about how the other half live in today's show. But first, before we get into that, what is in the mailbag today, Kaylee?
Well, I'm actually going to go in reverse order, as I usually go from least recent to most recent. So, coming in this afternoon from Sonal, who we had on the show last week.
Yes, that's right.
A quick non-comedy fest breath, two-word review for Antiviral, celebrity skinned. And also, she asked today if the all-knowing Cinematica cast knew if The Place Beyond the Pines would be coming out. And Rebecca McMillan replied, but I couldn't see the reply.
Oh, and basically nobody knows yet, but we do know that it's Roadshow, so, you know.
Dun, dun, dun!
Yes.
Do you mean we don't know if it's coming, or we don't know when it's coming?
It's not on anybody's release schedule yet.
Oh, my goodness. If they don't bring us that, there will be hell to pay.
Yep.
Well, there is. They've got previous, as they say in the English crime TV shows, so you know we know that there's every possibility that the discretion will be the better part of Roadshow's valor when it comes to this. But
Bill Gosden,
yeah, he's got to reach out and pluck it from obscurity.
Yes, from Miriam Ross, Iron Man 3 Stereo Downey, Chris Horman, also known as the Merca. Iron Man 3 Zesty Mandarin. I am so sorry. I love it.
That's great. Mm-hmm.
Well done. And also, I think what deserves special mention, I was away when this whole conversation went on, but we did tweet to stay after the credits of Iron Man 3 because there's a little blip at the end. Well, Red Patriot on Twitter went on a rampage about how he refuses to stay and how people are going to walk all over him and it's the worst thing in the world. And all we have to say is you don't have to. We just want to let you know that these things are there. Right. And if your friends wait and they want to talk about it, you're like, oh, I missed out on it.
He was deeply upset at the fact that even if he didn't want to stay, it was just going to be extremely annoying. For all concerned people, you know, there would be people coming in from the session that's just about to come in, wanting to check it before. I mean, it was just all, you know, it does throw things into disarray. These little post credits sequences, and the last one we saw was Iron Man 3, and it was the first time in a long time that I'd remembered to stay, and. You know, there are some of those post-credit sequences, they actually completely contradict the film that you've just seen. Like, they change the canon, they change the story. And so it's kind of important that you know, the film is a whole.
But do they change it such that in the subsequent film,
you needed to have known something.
It's consistent, or do they just do it just for a bit of a laugh, just to reward the people who stuck around?
There's an article somewhere on the internet which I will provide a link to, which I think does a good job of explaining how, you know, it's like when you know a character's died in the main film, but you know, the after the credit sequence, there's a slow tracking shot towards their corpse. This is like the villain, and then their eyes open, and boom, that's the end of the film. It's like, oh, so they're not dead then. You've just completely denied the whole of the rest of the film
like
that you've
the
just
end
seen.
Of the last season of Sherlock. It's like, oh, they're no, it's okay. It's okay, everyone. You know,
yeah, there'll be another series. Okay. Exactly. Yeah.
Sorry if I ruined that for anyone who hasn't seen it yet, but there you go.
No, but it's television. No, none of our listeners watch television.
No.
So, more mail?
No, that was it. So Red Patriot, it's okay. You don't have to stay. Yeah. Just calm down.
But thank you
for your passion, your passionate words on Twitter.
All right. What have New Zealanders been going to at the cinemas this weekend? We've got the box office figures for the 4-day weekend, 25th to the 28th of April, in front of me. And it's very interesting reading because at number 5, up 3 from 8, is Escape from Planet Earth, the 3D kids movie, school holiday fodder there. Down 1 at 4 is Olympus Has Fallen, which is probably no great surprise there. Down 1 at 3 is Oblivion, Tom Cruise, and that's currently made about 1.3 million at the New Zealand box office, which is, you know, not shabby, but down 1 at 2 is The Croods, which is in its third official week, but had a couple of weeks of sneaks beforehand. That's now at $2.7 million in New Zealand. And straight in at number 1, after only 4 days, Iron Man 3. Now, it did have midnight screenings on the Wednesday, so there was a little bit of money taken before the weekend started, but that is a $2.3 million weekend, ladies and gentlemen, for Iron Man 3. Over $3 million by the end of Monday. So a pretty spectacular success, you'd have to say, and doing continuing to do fantastic business everywhere. And I think the international box office projections for that are that it's pretty much well on the way to $1 billion US. Mm. So, yeah, good Lord indeed. And bigger than The Avengers, which does strike me as a bit of a surprise because I don't know if it had quite the marketing push that The Avengers had before it came out. So probably, you know, in terms of margins, in terms of profit for Marvel Studios and Disney, that's got to be a good effort. You weren't with us on the show last week, Sarah, so you didn't get a chance to partake in the Iron Man 3 discussion. But were you a fan? Are you a fan?
Well, I really liked it, but I have to be honest, why not here if nowhere else? I came out feeling ever so slightly underwhelmed. There were bits of it that I completely loved. I adored the whole Ben Kingsley character arc, and every line issued from his lips was genius. And I certainly woke up the next day thinking about the Guy Pearce's crowd with the bodies that glow amber, and I loved the bomb scene in Gelman's theatre and all that sort of thing. So there were bits of it that I super, super, super liked. But at the end of the day, I sort of felt as though it was just a whole lot of fighting and explosions and all that. So imagine my surprise when other critics in whom I hold in high esteem started giving it 5 stars and saying greatest superhero movie ever and all that sort of thing. So I don't know. Don't know really what I missed there, or I don't know. I mean, I liked it a lot, but I didn't love it as much as everybody else.
Going back to our response to it from last week, it was just like pure entertainment. That, you know, that just for a change, it wasn't a superhero movie that needed to score massive psychological or social or political points.
No,
you know,
that's true.
And
that's
on that
true.
Basis, you know, it had more fun per minute. than almost any of those superhero movies, and it managed to, the Avengers, vast swathes of Manhattan were destroyed in Iron Man 3. Pretty much it was restricted to Malibu.
Yes.
Which, I could live with that.
Yes.
Now, on the subject of superhero movies, tentpole movies, the big summer blockbusters, you were one of the few New Zealand media representatives to head over to Sydney last weekend. It was last weekend or the weekend before?
Well, it was last Monday.
Last
it was very, very early last Monday,
so
yeah.
Very, very early in last week. And you were whisked over to Sydney for the Australasian premiere of Star Trek Into Darkness. So,
it was indeed. No, you're right. Star Trek Into Darkness.
Yeah, good. I didn't have to look it up even. That's how on top of things I am today.
Not out of darkness. No, that's right.
Or Edge of Darkness. So tell me a little bit about, first of all, how you get approached to do something like that. Is it all sort of secret squirrel? You have to sign a whole lot of documentation. Are you even allowed to talk about it? This is my question.
Oh, I'm allowed to talk about it now. Yeah, absolutely. We went over very early Monday morning and hit Sydney in time for a 2 o'clock press screening. And I have to say, absolutely stoked to have been literally the first in the world outside of Paramount Pictures to see the film. So a bunch of Australasian media sat and watched the movie, as I say, 2 o'clock last Monday, in preparation for Tuesday, which was Junket Day. And so I already had time allocated, and when I say time, I'm talking 10 minutes each, with 10 minutes with J.J. Abrams and sort of 15 minutes with Chris Pine and Zachary Quinto. So obviously we have to see the film the day before so that we've got something to talk to them about. And then Tuesday night was, as you say, the Australasian premiere on George Street at the Event Cinemas in the heart of Sydney. And I was sort of thinking they were going to close off the whole road and go a bit Leicester Square on it, but they didn't.
Hobbity.
They closed
off the, did you think they were going to get hobbity about it?
They closed off a strip of pavement, and so and because I'm print journalist, I don't have to do red carpet with a camera and all that sort of thing. And I have to say, having spoken to my colleagues who went over, who are radio and TV, it sounds as though they do their main work in the morning of the junket, where they've got their cameras and they've got the, you know, sort of the dedicated moments with the talent. Out on the red carpet, you sort of at a bit of a loss of what to say. And as one of them said to me, the talent come along and you feel like saying, "So how's your day been?" You know, because it's only been a few hours since they saw them before. But in any event, we're then embargoed until Tuesday night. So until then, we did have to sign. You're not allowed to tweet. You're not allowed to say anything on any social media or in any public forum whatsoever.
Did they confiscate
about having seen the film, let alone what you thought of it?
Did they confiscate your cell phone?
I'm trying to remember. Curiously, they didn't take our phones from us, which they do, of course, don't they, in other sort of media screenings for big movies, but they didn't. But possibly it was because it was so tight and they knew exactly who was in there and we'd all signed forms that they probably, they could have got us if we had tried to do anything too crazy. So I wasn't even allowed to say on Twitter, "Oh, saw the Star Trek film and that was good." Then, of course, come 10 o'clock Tuesday night, it's all on, isn't it?
Well, that's right. And so you've seen it twice, or did you?
Well,
or did you go to the? Or did you go to the pub for the Tuesday
night
screening?
Okay, so no. Actually, what happened was on the Monday press screening. excuse me. They couldn't get us a 3D print in time, so we watched it in 2D.
Oh, shame. Oh.
I know. And without the closing credits, they were just sort of holding credits at the very end. But the rest of the film, it was completely post-production. It was like, it was totally ready to go.
Well,
but I'd only seen it in 2D. And then without wanting to get too many haters, I have actually seen the film again because I went to the Auckland media screening on Monday night this week and saw it in 3D with the closing credits and everything. So yeah, I have seen it twice. I've seen it in both formats, and I have to say the second time heightened the experience for me, and I sort of really, really came out of it loving the film. The first time I was like, yeah, that was really good, but I felt that there were more things that I could criticize about it. Seeing it the second time, I'm like, oh no, that's all fine. This is all amazing. It's wonderful. So whether we can attribute that to the 3D or just my good nature, I do not know.
Let's calibrate you now in terms of your Star Trek appreciationness.
Yeah.
And because I think this is important that this is measurable.
Yes.
How much of a fan were you beforehand? How much and how much do you think it matters?
I'm not remotely a Trekkie. I haven't seen, certainly not knowingly or rememberingly, any of the prior Star Trek movies up until J.J. Abrams' 2009 one, which I did see and I completely loved. And all I know is that I had or have a sufficient appreciation of the characters to know, I've heard obviously of Captain Kirk, Mr. Spock, Bones, Mr. Sulu to some extent and that sort of thing. So in the 2009 film, when he does his origin story and brings this band of misfits together, I had enough of an appreciation to go, hey, yeah, that's cool, because he will grow up to be William Shatner or he'll grow up to be Leonard Nimoy, but without really, without it being any more than that. So in answer to your question about whether sort of civilians, if you want to call them that, will enjoy these films, I would say categorically yes. I do not think that there are too many nods and winks and, you know, tips of the hat to the genre that it's remotely alienating for anybody who didn't grow up watching all of the TV series and all of the Next Generation and all that sort of thing, you know?
Right, well, the next question then we'll have to ask next week, I think, when I will have seen it, which is if you are a huge fan of the original series, does it diverge too much from the original platform to be disappointing in some way? Because that's, you know, it's taking on a life of its own now. We're in a completely parallel timeline.
That's right, yeah.
And so J.J. Abrams has got complete freedom to sort of take the characters in a direction, in completely different direction to the ones we knew. And, you know, question will be, you know, how do you balance that familiarity with novelty?
All I do know from having interviewed him last week, and I'm perfectly happy to say this now, I think we know that he's very committed to genres that have and franchises that have a serious fan base, and JJ, as I call him, JJ's sense of things
casually.
Is that first initial basis, he and I, JJ feels very strongly that he wanted to be faithful to the spirit of the Star Trek life, if you will, more than the letter of it. So he wanted to, maintain the spirit of it, but still give his cast the freedom to interpret their own characters, but with elements that are very Spock or very Shatner, but still putting a fresh take on it all. So he did mention that, you know, they'd got a bit of stick from some of the fan base for the 2009 film, but he did say, by and large, the fans were very gracious and very accepting. So that's all I know, really.
Okay. And Quinto and Pine, a little shiver down the spine.
That was a sigh for Pine and not Quinto, Kate.
No, it's all about Zachary Quinto.
Yeah.
Oh, right. I'm not really a pretty boy. I like the, you know.
A friend of mine, when the 2009 film came out, she immediately christened him Hot Spock, from now on, that's what he will always be known as. And you got to chat with the two of them. Was it together or separately?
Yeah, those two together.
Right, and do they have a sort of rapport together? Because I know that, you know, Shatner and Nimoy are still the best of mates, even though they're both into their late 80s now.
Do you know, I can only speak from the 12 or 15 minutes that I had with them, so I don't want this to be taken as anything other than just that moment. But all I know is that I got them in the afternoon. I had the first of the after lunch slots, and both of them seemed a little lower key than they appear when they're interviewed on telly or on the radio. And I think that's understandable because, again, if they're seeing a print journalist, they don't have to switch it on. And while there was absolutely no hint of anything other than friendship between them. There wasn't kind of a warmth and a banter and a playing around or anything like that.
They weren't finishing each other's sentences.
No, they weren't. They weren't. And it's interesting because the bromance in the film is really heightened, not in a dumb sort of pretending to be homoerotic way, but there's definitely a connection between their characters in the film. And so, as I say, I'm sure they get on well in real life, but it didn't come through in the interview. No, it didn't. And actually, I think that having seen clips of them interviewed, as I say, on telly or whatever, they're much more kind of personable and doing their thing. And then maybe they just came in after lunch and thought, oh, phew, we can relax for a little while.
Or maybe they just had a big lunch.
Much quieter. Yeah.
Maybe they just had a big lunch.
Quite possibly. And Zachary was sick. And the interesting thing is, at the end of the interview, they shook my hand and Zachary kept saying, look, I'm awfully sorry, I'm not very well. I hope I don't make you sick. And I said, and this will lead on nicely to a film that we're going to talk about shortly.
Oh my God.
I said, well, have you seen Brandon Cronenberg's film Antiviral? And they both went, no. And I said, well, you know, and I'm just going to mention this now, sorry for the spoiler for you guys, but obviously, it's about the harvesting of celebrity viruses where fans pay to be infected by that virus. And suddenly, they both livened up. And Chris was like, really? That sounds crazy. Is this a new film? You mean David's son? And was much more engaged.
Right.
And so I said to
Chris. So they weren't thinking of it as a potential revenue earner.
So no. Did you get a tissue from Zachary? That's what I need to know.
I didn't, but I never washed my hand again, Kaylee. I did. But as you can probably hear, I have indeed got sick. So I think I did get sick from Zachary.
Brilliant. Wow.
That is the most brilliant tie-in to the next film that we're going to talk about. Actually, I was going to jump to Jurassic Park, but we can do that a little bit later on. So let's talk about Antiviral after we hear from a little bit from the film now.
Fame, glamour, perfection. What if you could find it all at the tip of a needle? Here at the Lucas Clinic, we strive to bring you closer to celebrity than ever before. With samples drawn directly from the source, you can be connected in ways you never imagined.
Brandon Cronenberg, who we were just talking about a little bit before, and his first feature film as a director, Antiviral. He's the son of David Cronenberg, who has a reputation, shall we say, for pushing the envelope.
Although his more recent films are more kind of thriller without the body horror.
Oh, there's even A Dangerous Method had a subtext. It had body horror subtext. It wasn't as explicit.
Yes, but A History of Violence was a bit more straightforward.
Yeah. So, Antiviral. Kaylee, you're going to be our
Canadian correspondent.
Yes, indeed.
Yes. We mentioned earlier, it is by Brandon Cronenberg, and it is about a future, very stark, sterile, it's kind of depressing future, really.
Very gloomy,
very stark, about companies, very high-end companies, extract viruses from celebrities who are ill so their clients can come in and inject themselves and share the virus and basically ingest something of their favorite celebrity. And it's not just, we find out it's not just viruses, that they actually grow cells from the celebrities as well, so you can eat your favorite celebrity in the form of a steak or a sausage or other meat products from specialty delis that they have. Now, our lead character, Sid, goes to collect a virus. One of his coworkers is fired. He gets to go be the, he gets kind of a
There's a black market as well, isn't there? There's the legitimate sort of high-level, very expensive, clean and probably regulated version of this industry. But there's also a bit of a black market going on, and he's playing both sides, isn't he?
Yeah, when he goes to collect the virus from Hannah Geist, one of their top celebrities, he immediately injects himself to start the virus growing in him so he can take it and sell it on the black market. And things get very, very complicated when she dies. Bum, bum, bum.
And dies in a pretty rough way as well. And so there's a sense that this isn't just your common or garden flu or even bird flu. This is something else that's going on here. So what we've got going on here is we've got a sort of it's body horror, but it's also a satire of modern celebrity consumerism and reality television, and you know, there's a lot of very, very clever ideas going on in here.
Body fetishization.
Yes,
however you say that word.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. So, so on one level, it's a sort of an old fashioned creepy horror, including featuring one of the great creepy actors, Malcolm McDowell, turning up, and you think, all right, yes, you're giving this the seal of approval, aren't you? But apart from him, there was nobody else in the film that I recognised. But of course, the Canadian on the show does recognise a few people.
Yes, this is a film that was definitely Canadian. If you are from Canada or a big fan of Canadian television and movies, you will recognize quite a few faces in here. Caleb Landry Jones, who plays Sid March, he's had some small roles. He's done all of the regular Canadian television shows, but was also in The Last Exorcism. He had a short moment in that. And he's fantastic at this character. He's so gaunt and thin and freckly.
He's got a brilliant face. He's got a really brilliant face. Expressive face, yeah.
Yeah. We have Nicholas Campbell, who's actually quite big in Canada. He was the boss of the big corporation that Sid worked for.
Sarah Gadon, you know the woman who plays Hannah Geist?
Yes.
She, interestingly, turns up in a lot of Cronenberg Senior's movies. So she was in Cosmopolis, which, of course, we didn't get here, but which I have seen. And that was at Cannes at last year, and so was Antiviral. So two Sarah Gadon films in two Cronenberg films at the same time in the same festival, and all that sort of thing. And she turned up in A Dangerous Method as well.
Yes, she did.
Something I'd like that I would want to point out about Antiviral is that it is a classic low budget first feature, in that that you can tell that there are a lot of very clever shortcuts taken by the art department in order to repurpose various sort of everyday objects in a very sinister or high technology manner. And I get the impression, I don't really know if this is true, Sarah, you might be able to reinforce this or not, that what budget that they did have, they threw at a two or three really, really big scenes and big prosthetic effects. Would that be right?
I don't know. I don't know anything about the detail of that. I did attend attended an interview between David and Brandon at Cannes, where they sort of chatted to one another about the way they make their films. But there wasn't anything on that.
Right. There's a lot of it where you think you're just using somebody's apartment, aren't you? Or you've just painted somebody's apartment white,
yeah,
What have you? Or you know, a picture theater or what have you? But then there are some dream sequences where the makeup effects, and a lot of it is practical. It seemed to me there was very little actual digital enhancement in this film. There's some extremely creepy practical makeup effects in there that are. Yeah, that will have you
squirming
definitely. Yeah.
There's one in particular that really just, it's like, yeah, that's very David, like that's very David Cronenberg, and it's almost like a little homage to his father. It yes. might not be, but there's just this one that's haunting me, and I can't get it out of my head. I won't spoil it for you.
I sat next to a friend of mine who was very much looking forward to seeing the film, but hadn't really done much research about what it was about. And the fact that she had just had surgery the previous week meant that she was squirming in particular. So if you've got some kind of a medical phobia or
you're hungry, or you're planning on eating any meat products in the future.
Yeah.
There are some extreme close-ups, even just of needles going into skin, aren't there? And there would be a lot of people in the audience for whom that is not cool.
Yes, that is a major sort of transition, using the needle into skin, because it is so much about the blood transfusion, I guess. So if you're wary of needles, you may want to, you know,
look away now.
Look away several times.
I thought the conceit, though, was, I mean, I think you're quite right, Dan, that in a way, I mean, when I started watching it, it felt very much like a very high-end student movie, student film, because it was so simple in its aesthetic and everything. And some of the acting at the very beginning seemed a little bit amateur, but not Caleb Landry Jones, notably. I think he was sensational. But I just couldn't stop thinking throughout the whole film, this is so clever, this is so clever. And as you said, Kaylee, the fact that they make steaks, they harvest cells from the celebrities and then grow more muscle or skin or tissue or whatever it is and make those into steaks to sell, I just kept thinking, this guy, Brandon, is a genius for coming up with this idea. I thought it was marvelous.
Because we can, that's what scientists are working on, is growing cells, so you don't have to transplant. You know, if you're doing a graft, you can grow skin cells.
They're printing 3D livers now.
Yeah. Yeah, this is, and you know, reading reviews of how this, it's an impossible future and this wouldn't happen, it's very possible. You know, aside from the machine that gives the virus a face, you know, it's very much, you know, that science possible.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
While I loved all of the ideas behind it, and I thought that there was a tremendous imagination there and a great harnessing of the material, it did feel to me like it sort of lost its way plot wise a little bit in the final act. Like I'm really impressed by the setup, but not so much by how it all got wrapped up.
Yeah, sure.
At the end, I think that's the sort of first featureitis maybe. So that, you know, just rest assured, I'm not looking to give this one 5 stars. I think that this is definitely, you know, this chap Cronenberg's a name to look out for. just to sum up, how did you feel about it, Kaylee? Was it is it going to be on your top 10 list for the year?
I think it will be. I was really looking forward to seeing it, even though I'm not much of a horror person. But I definitely wanted to see what Brandon could come up with. I know that there wasn't a lot of government. It looks like there wasn't a whole bunch of government funding for the film. So that would be why it'd be low budget. Even if you were getting government funding, there's not much. But there's a really interesting quote that I found of his when he was talking about how Marilyn Monroe was included on the 2012 Cannes Film Festival poster. And he said, "A celebrity is a cultural construct that's unrelated to the human being and continues to exist independent of the life and death of the human being. It's kind of ironic, but at the same time, what better place to have a discussion about celebrity?" And I think that sums up the film really well.
It does.
And the idea behind the film. So, this is definitely going to be in my top 10 list. I was very impressed. The whole sort of low budget but stark and clever really, really reminded me of you know, early first Canadian features. So it definitely holds a special place in my heart.
All right. Did you have 2 words for us?
My 2 words. I'm going to go a little bit over the top, but I'm going to go with prestigious son.
Nice work. Sarah, you're summing up and your 2 words. I know you've been honing your 2 words while you've been preparing for the show.
I thought it was a terrific film. I thought it far exceeded my expectations. And because when I'd first heard about it, I'd thought, oh, I bet he just does he just follows in his dad's footsteps. And I think that completely discredits, or, you know what I mean? It doesn't give credit to Cronenberg Jr. So I thought it was terrific. I don't know if it'll be my top 10 from enjoyment and whatnot, but I was very, very impressed. And my 2-word review would be sickeningly precocious.
Nice work. Good. I'm going to come up with just a 1-word review for Antiviral, and that is... So, time for some news.
This year's Outtakes Festival launched their program earlier this week. The festival is going to run in Auckland and Wellington this year and last for 2.5 weeks. That's 3 weekends, including, of course, Queen's birthday. Woo! There are 17 features from all over the world and several programs of themed short films. You can check out the full schedule and make bookings at outtakes.org.nz, and we'll put the link in the show notes.
Yep, indeed. And I had a look through the program a little bit earlier on this week, and there was nothing that I was already sort of anticipating or familiar with, but that doesn't mean that there isn't some gems. So even if you're not in the LGBT community, and you're just a cinephile, it's worth checking out that site. And
also, usually a good place to see some interesting Canadian films.
More Canadian films, mm-hmm. Indeed.
I'm going to have to look up this program. Represent. Steven Soderbergh is on the verge of retirement from filmmaking, or so he says, but he took time out from ticking off his cinematic bucket list with a State of the Industry speech at the San Fran International Film Festival. Despite his wish that the event not be blogged or recorded, you can now watch a full video of it as he ranted, his own word, about the state of the medium, starting off with a discussion of the difference between movies and cinema.
Yep, and if I hadn't had a massive internet meltdown this morning at home, we might have actually had a few clips from that, because he did. It was very interesting, a lot of what he's said, and has stirred up a lot of debate. So we'll be adding some links to that. Interesting, he talks about, just on the subject of the difference between movies and cinema, he says there's a reason this isn't called the state of the movies speech. Movies is a dirty word, and it's movies that are strangling cinema. First of all, is there a difference? Yeah. The simplest way that I can describe it, he says, is that a movie is something you see, and cinema is something that's made.
Ooh.
Clever bugger. So yes, we'll be linking to that and seeing if we can't kick off a little bit of debate around the Twitter sphere as well. Lots and lots of people responding to that, because, you know, one of the most thoughtful people working in commercial cinema. And apparently, even though he's been saying that, you know, he's about to retire, he did drop a few hints about Magic Mike 2. Yeah.
I'll be lining up to see that, let me tell you. Opening night. I'll be there.
So, time to move on to current releases. Now, this is something that's a little bit of a trend that we're noticing, and that is films being released in Auckland, but not Wellington, or not yet in Wellington. So, we'll just have a little bit of audio from West of Memphis.
Nothing ever happens in West Memphis, Arkansas.
We've had 3 children missing since last night.
3 young boys murdered in cold blood.
Arrested at 2:44 p.m., charged with 3 counts of capital murder.
It was like a nuclear bomb going off in the courtroom.
Life imprisonment without parole. Death by lethal injection.
And the terror of mortal men looked favorably on my sacrifice.
Kaylee, you have seen West of Memphis. When did you see it?
I saw it at the 2012 New Zealand International Film Festival, so it has been a little while, but I was lucky enough to be at the session with a Q&A with Peter Jackson and the lead person in the film, whose name I should remember, but just escaped my brain.
Damien Eccles.
Thank you. Yes, Damien Eccles and his partner were there, which was wonderful. So it was a very interesting and insightful Q&A, as insightful as Wellington Q&As can be, you know, how they go sometimes. So yes, this is a feature film produced and, I'm assuming, yes, directed by Peter Jackson about the West Memphis Three, and it's the kind of where things are now with their trial. There was another film that came out around the same time, but they did not, it's part of a trilogy, but they did not get permission from Damien Eccles or the other members to make that film. So this is the more...
The official version.
This is the official version of their story about what happened and what went down. It's been a very long trial process. If you're not familiar with it, I won't try to sum it up, but...
It's interesting you say that, though, because I haven't seen this film, but I have seen the third of the
Paradise Lost trilogy.
Yes, and they're all interviewed in those films, at length. So one wonders, you know, what sort of permissions were or weren't.
I can tell you what happened there.
Yes, Sarah.
Well, apparently, because I too have seen the 3 Paradise Lost films and I have not yet seen West of Memphis, and I'm terribly keen to, but I have to be honest, there was this little part of me that, as much as I support Peter Jackson and everything he does, I heard that when the filmmakers, and I think, in fact, a young woman called Amy Berg is the director, but
yes,
you're absolutely right,
apologies.
Peter Jackson and Fran and everybody were behind West of Memphis, and they got to the stage where they were shooting their film, and they actually, they got the people to sign that they would not talk to the people of the third film. I think it had to be kind of an exclusive, if you know what I mean. So I think it's Tom Berninger, I think if that's his name, who made the Paradise Lost films, and they weren't able to get quite as much for their third film. or maybe, because obviously West of Memphis takes us to the end of the story, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does.
That's spoiler right. There's a bit of competition going on because the third Paradise Lost film had to rapidly change its ending because of some sort of judicial twists that happened after they'd finished sort of principal photography. So they got a little bit sort of left in the lurch. But you'd have to say that, you know, three films on the same subject, that the filmmakers for Paradise Lost have been following this story for a long, long time, and
literally have since 93 or whatever.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly, and made a huge commitment, and so it all does seem a little bit sort of icky, really, doesn't it? And from a decency perspective, one way or another, somebody's being.
I think my sympathy is, and I know that I'm completely overplaying this, but to me, it's like the underdogs, as you say, were there. They were there in 93 or whenever the original trial happened. They were there on the ground, starting to make people to cast doubt on the guilt of these three lads who were convicted of brutally massacring and murdering two young boys. And it was all just so nasty and so horrible. And were it not for, and I'm sure it is Tom Berninger, were it not for him and his crowd, who knows whether this story would have really taken off. But you're right, three documentaries and 12 or however many years, can't do the math, more than that, later, it does seem a little unfair that, you know, Mr. Lord of the Rings swoops in and makes his film and flies Damien Eccles around the world to do Q&As and whatnot, and suddenly everyone's like, oh my gosh, have you heard of this story? It's like really important. There was like a total miscarriage of justice. And it's like, well, that was back then, you know?
Exactly.
But that doesn't deny the power of the story or the strength of the central characters. And Damien Eccles, I know from the previous films, is a very powerful advocate for himself and his friends and for his story. So, you know, it's a compelling story whichever way you approach it from. Kaylee, do you just quickly, can you sum up with something as big as this in just two words, or are you able to?
My two words, which encompasses many things, including, you know, as you touched on, you know, Peter Jackson coming along and suddenly it's as important, but also this being a very important film, talking about the you know, getting to the end of the trial and what's happening now, even though this crime happened so long ago. My two words are power play.
Good stuff. Time to go to the ballet now.
I started dancing just for fun, but now it's so much more than that.
People don't realize how hard it is to make it as a dancer.
Kids who are pursuing ballet as a career give up their childhood.
It never stops hurting. You've been working your body to death since you were like five.
Tenacity is the main thing that a dancer needs. You have to follow your dream.
First Position, the new documentary about young contenders for a career on the stage. And I found this one to be, you know, amazingly rewarding, but at the same time really frustrating. So,
did you cry?
No,
I cried.
Oh, did you?
Did you cry?
I got a little bit misty in Jig too. I don't. It's like dance movies. I'm just like, oh,
Jig. Boy, oh boy. Okay.
It was emotional.
Did you cry when the mother cried?
I can't quite remember. I don't think so. It was more. It's like you get so excited for these adorable children, and you're like, oh, and they're performing, and yeah.
All right. Which one of you wants to give us the lowdown?
I'll give you a quick lowdown. Basically, First Position is a documentary about six young people from, they keep saying, six young people from six continents, because we've got kids from Canada and Israel and Colombia and United States of America, and they are all competing at the highest level of ballet dancing in the Youth America Grand Prix. And the point of the competition is that they are vying for places either at prestigious ballet schools, or if they're at the upper end, like 17, 18, they're trying to get into actual ballet companies around the world, like in London and so on. And that's the very straightforward premise of the documentary.
So how did you feel about it?
I really loved it. And And it's interesting because normally documentaries for me are powerful either if they take some sort of criminal miscarriage of justice, in which case the subject matter is inherently something I would get very passionate about, or you've got subjects, i.e. actual people in the film, who are so characterful that that you either love them or hate them. And the interesting thing about First Position for me is that of the six children that are profiled, yes, they all have very compelling stories, but none of them is a little drama queen or a brat or particularly over the top. And what's compelling, I think, is their dedication to their craft, the extraordinary dancing. I mean, every time one of them gets on stage and performs, I was aghast. And I think that's incredibly powerful, that it didn't need to be emotionally wrought or, as I say, over-characterized or anything like that for it to be an incredibly compelling watch.
Do you have a background in dance, Sarah? Were you one of those little girls on a Saturday morning dragged there by your parents? You don't have
a
history.
Those who can dance, those who can't go to the movies.
I want to show this film to every parent who is thinking about taking their kids to Saturday morning ballet classes. In fact, maybe not even the whole film, but just the section on injuries, I think,
yeah.
Which was, it was as horrific, that scene, as any of the Saw movies that I've seen. What these young people put themselves through in terms of, I mean, just looking at these kids' feet, it's insane. You know, it's the damage and one character who is talking about right up till 20 minutes before she goes on about whether she's even going to be able to, to dance, whether she could just bail out because she might do herself a permanent injury, and this is somebody who's only 17 or 18 years old.
Yeah.
It's a warning as well as a celebration. You're right. All of these characters deserve success. All of these characters have great potential and would benefit from winning or getting a major sort of success in the competition. My problem with the film is that it's like a classic like Spellbound, that sort of competition where people are being weeded out, and then it goes right up to the wire, and it's like a sports movie in that sense. And you know that not everyone's going to make it, and I don't know. I just felt manipulated by that. I felt like there were people who were going to deserve to succeed who weren't going to succeed, and that was a bit
life,
of
life, Dan.
Yeah, it is, but it seemed to me that I just felt like you could tell this story without the tense sort of string music at the end where the envelopes are being opened and what have you. I mean, I know that that's the stuff of drama, and I know But it's a formula now, it seems to me, and that I don't know if this particular story needed to be shoehorned into that particular formula the way that it was.
Mm-hmm.
But Kaylee, you might feel differently. Please do, while I pick up my script.
I don't know. I really enjoyed it. I'm not sure. I mean, obviously, yes, there is a formula. Once you get all of your footage and you get into the editing room, it will take its course. But at the same time, as a documentary filmmaker, if you have subjects who are just so interesting but may not succeed, I mean, that's still someone you want to go with. And you want there to be drama because unlike these competition, films that you often see, it's more about the competition and training for it. This one was really about the youth involved, and you kind of get to know them and learn about their lives. So yeah, that's why I shed a few tears. I was like so stressed. But I found it really enjoyable. I love dance documentaries. So.
Right. So let's try and sum up, if we can. Who wants to go first with their summary and maybe even two words?
I can give you a two-word review. Mm-hmm. Mine is on point.
Okay, I'm still trying to work mine out, trying to wrestle my thoughts down into two words. Kaylee, do you have two?
Yes, my two words for First Position are danser, danser.
All right. Nice. Okay, mine would be competitive swans for first position. And that's a film that's actually playing pretty widely around the country, I think. So if you're looking for something that's a bit of an antidote to the loud noise, wisecracks and explosions of Iron Man 3, then first position. But it's very much a cautionary tale, I think.
I own an island off the coast of Costa Rica. I've spent the last 5 years setting up a kind of biological preserve.
What got in there, King Kong?
Welcome to Jurassic Park.
Sarah, I saw a DCP restored version of Jurassic Park in flat 2D last year and thought that it was perfectly fine. Now it's coming back in 3D. What difference does it make, do you think?
I'm not entirely sure, because I shrieked when I saw this. There was that, I don't think this is a spoiler, there's that many wonderful moments where a raptor suddenly pshks out at you, and I still shrieked. And I've seen the film a million times, and I should have known it was coming. But was that the 3D, or was that just me sort of feeling the nostalgia? It's hard to say.
Or was that Spielberg weaving his magic once again?
Do you know, I honestly think, 20 years on, what amazed me about Jurassic Park, and as I say, I've seen it a couple of times since the very first time, but invariably, I guess, on telly, the thing that amazes me is that it isn't actually too dated. It really holds up. I think part of the pleasure is that, you know, we've all seen the same clip time and again of Sam Neill and then Laura Dern sort of peering up over that little car-mobile thing that they drive in. We've seen the look, we've seen the glass of water on the dashboard starting to shake. And when you revisit those sort of seminal moments, there's a bit of a thrill. But Laura Dern looks $1 million 20 years ago. Sam Neill was once a sex symbol or something. It's crazy.
Yeah. And he was shortlisted for James Bond at one point.
Oh dear.
Yeah.
All I know is that Bob Peck, English actor, has the best legs I've seen on any man on screen for as long as I can remember. And the dinosaurs were still thrilling. And the dinosaurs, I don't know if they were animatronic or if they were special effects at the time, but they still look fantastic.
I think it was a mixture when it was done.
It was. There was some digital and a lot of actual sort of mechanized. But you can't really tell when one stops and one starts.
You can't. And they're all equally frightening. Probably not the diplodoci or whoever it is, those herbivore ones, but do you know what I mean? They're still compelling. But, so I loved it.
Yeah, and as we mentioned when we were talking about antiviral a little bit earlier on, of course, not a million miles away from our future, ladies and gentlemen. If they're cloning human beings for steaks, they'll be cloning dinosaurs.
Science really did hold up. That whole, you know, get the dinosaur blood out of the mosquito thing. I was like, yeah, that can totally happen.
You bought it.
I bought it.
Still buy it.
Okay.
To this day.
So, two words for us, so we can wrap that up.
I think because Spielberg did such a great job then and continues to now, I would say prehistoric precedent.
That, ladies and gentlemen, is our show for this week. It's another big week next week, because we're going to go back into the kitchen for Haute Cuisine, and also Robert Redford is on the run in The Company You Keep, a film that he is also directed. So all that and more in next week's no doubt exciting episode of New Zealand's favourite movie podcast, Cinematica. If you've enjoyed this episode, don't forget you can click subscribe in iTunes or whatever your own favourite podcasting software is. If you're not in the iTunes world, you can still find a way to do that, so that the latest episode is always downloaded automatically. Leave us feedback at the iTunes store, because the ratings and reviews really help other people discover the show. And you can also contact us via various social media and old-fashioned methods. Kaylee, you are communications executive.
Yes. Does that include a pay rise?
Yeah.
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 Sweet. More donuts. You can find us on Twitter at CinematicaCast. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/cinematicapodcast, on our website at cinematica.co.nz, and on Letterboxd as Cinematica.
Good stuff. This show is a Guns of Steel production. The theme music is 6x6 by Earl Van Dyke, and you can buy that at the iTunes store. Simon will be back next week. He's busy overseas at the moment at a conference where no doubt he will be bringing back lots of important news and bits of gossip from the cinema world.
Hopefully some presents.
And maybe some presents. Yeah, yeah. You know what? That would mean he would have to remember us while he's actually overseas. But I suspect he's having far too good a time.
Okay. I'll raid Ian's prize buckets.
We're going to leave you now with some more music. I don't know what it is yet, because this morning was a bit of a write-off in terms of research, but no doubt we're being played out by something very, very nice. Until next week, that is all from me.
And all from me.
And I guess that's all from me.
Thank you very much for joining us on the show. You've been such a splendid guest host.
Pleasure. Always a pleasure. Anytime.